Hello and welcome back. I didn't think any of you would be back for more Motley Crue, but here you are. Tonight, Mike and I look at the album that really made them rise in popularity and really began their secret weapon having to do all of the heavy lifting. The Dirt, a Motley Crue retrospective on Renegade Jukebox tonight, gets introduced by a washed-up glam singer. Take it away, Vince.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to episode 2 of The Dirt, a Motley Crue retrospective. My name is Mike. I'll be your host this evening. Joining me, as always, is a Super Saiyan death metal god himself, Nick.
I am not doing Vince Neil impressions for all of you. That ain't happening. We've got the intros to embarrass the man already as is. I'm not doing any impressions of the guy.
Yeah, smart choice.
Although apparently I can do a very spot on Kickstart My Heart, which we'll mention when we get to Dr. Feelgood.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. But before we get there, we, of course, have gotten to their second studio album and kind of a big one, too, in a big year. This is 1983's Shout at the Devil. Now, before we get to our overall thoughts on the record, can we just take a minute to talk about what a stacked year 1983 was?
I mean, sure, but I also don't have the Wikipedia in front of me right now. At this rate, I hardly even keep track of like album anniversaries for my own Instagram page. Like, I know The Satanist by Behemoth just had like a 10-year anniversary. I know that has nothing to do with 83, but The Satanist came out 10 years ago back at the beginning of the month. And I'm like, yeah, I could do a post about it, but I just don't have time to keep track of all of this.
Understandable. And for this year, especially, there's like at least half a dozen heavy hitters. Like, obviously we've got this one, but we have Peace of Mind by Iron Maiden, Metallica's Kill 'Em All, Melissa by Merciful Fate, Bark at the Moon by Ozzy Osbourne, Holy Diver, the list goes on and on.
So I was just going to drop this in as a little behind the scenes for everybody. Mike's already seen this before we started recording, but since we are still in the box set, as we're going to say throughout these episodes for the 80s albums, I obviously have the album on the 2023, I want to say, repressing of the album, and with a really cool splatter variant that, again, I already showed him, but it's in this really killer yellow and black variant that's really awesome. Well, that, and just include the fact that there was, again, like we said in the last episode, just trying to get to the 40th anniversary of this album in time, like, we wanted to get to that and include that. Yeah, there's a box set, and we do typically want to mention where people can actually get these, but I'd say that'd get pretty redundant fast, considering it's a $100 box set that you can get off of Amazon. You can get that off of Revolver's website. I mean, it's a pretty, I don't want to say standard collector item, but it's pretty easy to find. Let's just put it that way.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, I guess with all of that in mind, and also just to kind of fill in the gaps, really, is there was two things I actually wanted to mention. One, just to kind of, you know, fill time and space. But one, I forgot to mention when we were mentioning like how we first heard of the band or got into them. I actually am the only one of the two of us who's actually met a member of Motley Crue, even.
Oh, yeah, I've heard the story before, but where was it that you met this band member?
I was taking my best friend to go see Papa Roach, and he mainly really wanted to see them. But at my old job, I used to work at an HMV back when that was a thing here in Canada. And there was a promotion going on to promote the show. If you bought their most recent albums, Papa Roach and 6AM's albums, you could go meet the band the next day. So it was like all you had to do is shell out $6 to buy the album. You get a wristband and you show up outside the store and you get your album signed.
That was honestly pretty cool.
Oh, it was better than having to give Ticketmaster like $300, $400 for an overpriced meet and greet photo op. I mean, I got to talk to Nikki Sixx for like 30 seconds, got my album signed. I'm not going to bitch too much. Then the main part that I was just saying was kind of the time filler part of it, just given that I'm the Canadian in the room and this happened in the city I live in. So apparently during the tour promoting Too Fast for Love, they decided to do this as a bunch of PR stunts. Like there was a lot that they did in my city. Apparently the band claimed that they had gotten arrested, then released at our airport for wearing spiked stage wardrobe, which apparently was considered, quote, dangerous weapons through customs. And in typical Vince Neil fashion, the most embarrassing thing that the guy can do, showed up with a small carry-on filled with porn in it.
Typical Neil.
Yeah. Then apparently the second one is that they were playing some venue that I have never even heard of, like long before I even lived here. Apparently there was a bomb threat against the band, but even that was falsified. Like even apparently their manager at the time and Tommy Lee did an interview behind it. And there was also a claim that they were banned from ever playing here again, which they obviously would play here multiple times over the years, so not like that would have mattered. So I just thought that was something that was noteworthy. It was like, oh, this is a cool thing that happened in my city, or didn't in this case.
Wow.
So I guess with the time filler in mind, just because there's not really a lot of fascinating studio history behind the making of Shout at the Devil, there's not really a ton aside from all aftermath type stuff, like the Ozzy tour and how infamous that was. I guess with that all in mind, to kind of piggyback off of what I said in the last episode of hoping that the next album is better, and again, to establish this for new listeners, this is the first time me and Mike are hearing these albums front to back. So I even told a coworker that I had never heard Shout at the Devil in its entirety until this week.
And to get right to my overall thoughts, this album is great. It honestly, if I were to make a top five of 1983, this would be right smack in the middle.
Oh, I can't help but agree. My entire attitude about this record is that it feels less glam metal and feels less like typical 80s hairband kind of shtick. It just feels more like an old school metal record. And I think if you recommended it to people in that kind of regard, people would be a lot more warm towards it rather than it's a Motley Crue album, who the fuck cares. But no, this is genuinely worth listening to. Like if you're into stuff like the first couple Iron Maiden records, into Judas Priest, into Dio, like you could put this alongside a lot of those albums and it'd go together pretty perfectly. And at only like 35 minutes, like it's a breeze to get through.
I called this off air all killer, no filler.
Ironic enough, since we're probably going to bring that up in terms of the intro, I couldn't help but think of Sum 41's first album and just going, God, they kind of do this intro way better and kind of make it sound more, for lack of a better phrase, grand. But it really is just designed to get Crew to walk on stage and just go straight into our first song proper.
Yeah, basically. So obviously, this intro aside, this album kicks off with the title track, Shout at the Devil.
You all know this song, but fun fact for those who aren't that familiar or don't have the ability to just use their thumbs and go to Wikipedia. Shockingly, it was never released as a single, actually, like even during the height of the Satanic Panic. And this album really was closely associated with a lot of that going on at the time. Amazingly, that was never capitalized on.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I only learned recently that Shout at the Devil was never actually a single. Despite hearing this like quite prominently in the glam metal episode of Heavy, The Story of Metal, I always just kind of assumed, because of like the album's reputation, that this just was one of the singles, but nope.
And for real, like the song gets the album off to a great start. I mean, the riff is really punchy. Mick gets to show off a lot more than he did on the last album. Tommy Lee sounds really good, actually, behind the kit. I mean, he's just drumming his ass off, as you know, kind of basic as it can be, but still, you have little bits of double kick and a lot more tom work going on. Vince, he sounds comprehensible, unlike nowadays. I'm not sorry, people. There will be jokes about his current state made throughout this entire series. But honestly, every band member here, for the most part, brings a lot of energy and something to the table, which I feel gets it off to almost a stronger start than Too Fast for Love, really. And I really do like Livewire as a song, but I do think this is the better way to start an album off and not just kind of have it kind of flatline.
No, I agree with that. I think I like Livewire a little bit more just like as a standalone song, but specifically an album opener, Shout the Devil accomplishes the job better.
Also, just so this way I don't have to repeat it so much throughout this episode, all I have to say is thank God this isn't self-produced anymore. This is the first of, I'm going to say, three up until Girls, Girls, Girls that Tom Werman worked on, and he needed to be behind the mixing board for this thing, because the polished production here does work to the album's benefit. Like, it still has dirt under its nails, obviously. It still sounds like the band is playing on the songs. I mean, it's the 80s. This is all pre-Pro Tools and everything, and pre-auto-tune, but really, it still has dirt under its nails. It still has energy and attitude behind it. It's a great way to kick off a record. I will say this, though. I do kind of prefer the Guitar Hero 2 mix of this. I'm not going to lie.
It's been a minute since I've played Guitar Hero 2, but yeah, I do remember that sounding much better.
For some reason, I thought that was how Motley Crue sounded back when I was in grade 7 when I played that game, because I had obviously heard some of the stuff on the radio that you typically hear, but I hadn't heard a lot of metal that I had sought out in my own free time at that point. And I just honestly kind of couldn't help but go like, wow, this actually sounds really cool. I got to check this song out and add it to my iPod, back when iPods were a thing. And then I download the song off of LimeWire at the time, because it's 2007, obviously. I just ended up downloading it and going like, how come this doesn't sound as crunchy as the Guitar Hero 2 version? Not knowing that they didn't have the license to actually use those songs.
Oh yeah, so that was one of the as performed by versions.
Pretty much. But to kind of hop into more of this record, we also get another genuinely really good song. Looks That Kill is actually a really great lead-off single. Kind of what I can say about the previous song can apply here, but every member really does bring something to the table throughout this song. And really, this is the Mick and Tommy show. And I think even with, in terms of one later record in particular, Motley Crue's only better when it's the Mick and Tommy show.
I have to agree with that. Mick and Tommy are the heart and soul of that rhythm section. And Looks That Kill probably is just one of my favorite Motley Crue songs in general, because it has everything. It has that punk rock attitude, but the musicianship of like traditional heavy metal.
Yeah, it does kind of have the four on the floor feel of the last album. Sure, you could argue, but the production really just makes the song all that punchier and makes it feel a lot more, I hate to use the word anthemic, but it gets that chorus stuck in your brain immediately without it just feeling like, okay, it's just redundant repeating the same title over and over and over again. Because finally, after that second repeat of the chorus, we finally get to hear Mick do a really great guitar solo here. Like, you guys just heard that, like, Too Fast for Love. I don't hate that record exactly. Dare I say, some of it I did enjoy quite a bit, but this just kicks things off without just, again, flatlining halfway through and just never really lets off the momentum.
To paint a picture of like the difference in quality, but like just in production value between Too Fast for Love and Shout at the Devil. This is pretty much the music equivalent of Kevin Smith's debut Clerks following up with Mallrats. Like the jump in quality is noticeable.
And up next, we have a technically notorious song. This actually was targeted by Tipper Gore and the PMRC back in the 80s. Mm. Yeah, the joys of the filthy 15, trying to put the fucking moral panic at the time. Bastard, another genuinely really good song. Like, again, remember, Mike, in the last episode, how I found some of the punkier style getting pretty redundant even at this point?
Can't say that about this album.
Oh, it's the opposite problem here. We get a much faster... like in terms of punk rock, a much faster song with a lot more attitude behind it. And even in the first 20 seconds of the song, Mick gets to do a sweet pick section. Can't ever go wrong with sweet picking. Lyrically, it's not exactly that interesting. It's really just kind of about their manager screwing them over during the making of the last album. But again, just be grateful it's not the album just falling flat on its face after two good songs and then just having to wait three or four more to get to something worth listening to. But it does what it needs to do. It just gets in and gets out really quick.
A quick spoiler for the rest of the album. One thing that that Shout at the Devil isn't is front loaded.
Thankfully, yeah, because that's mostly how I felt about the first one so much. Is just it really felt like, okay, we're off to a really good start. This is better than going quicker than I expected. Then I'm like, okay, like, can we just get to the title track already?
I'm so glad that like it honestly feels like they've learned a lot of lessons from their debut and pretty much brought only their strengths to this record.
Which, speaking of strengths, we get the opportunity for Mick Mars to show off.
God bless the children of the beasts. Yeah, this is Mick Mars flexing for like a minute and a half, and it's glorious.
Honestly, as more of a melodic death metal guy, I really like this little transition track. Yeah, you could go, it's just filler to get to the cover song next, but for me, like Mike said, it's just an excuse for Mick to do a big melodic solo, and for me, that's never going to be a bad excuse. Exactly. Now, honestly, I'm not gonna lie, I bring up being a bigger melodic death metal fan because I couldn't help but go, this is kind of reminding me of some of the transition tracks on War Eternal by Arch Enemy.
Yeah, now that you mention it, it definitely has that vibe. I almost thought for a second I turned on an Arch Enemy record or even like, it kind of has a bit of an Iron Maiden like aesthetic to it too.
Yeah, and the thing that annoyed me, I don't really like jumping too far ahead in these, and like I like using unnecessary trivia to kind of pad things out a little bit, but I got annoyed reading this on the Wikipedia page. Apparently some members of the band were wanting to kick Mick out of the band even at this stage in their career and wanting to get a more technically proficient guitarist, and I'm just kind of sitting here going like, you dumbasses failed miserably and it worked out for the better.
Yeah, I won't pretend like Mick is the best guitarist of this era, but like, he's still really damn good.
He's better than certain other members of this band, and I'm not even going to say Vince because I'm not going to exclusively pick on him. I will mention this eventually when I get to like any kind of faults I have with this record, if anything, but with all that in mind, I'm probably going to let you have the floor with this one because I know you really dig this cover.
Okay, so one, unlike the band, I'm a huge Beatles fan. And I'm also very strict when it comes to Beatles covers. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. Motley Crue's rendition of Helter Skelter is awesome. They found a way to take what was already like a great song off the White Album and make it their own. And it is amazing.
My only guess though, why it's here is just to kind of add to the evil factor of it all though, just because of the Charles Manson association though.
You're not wrong. I'm like, that's probably one of the easiest reasons why they chose this song of any of them to cover.
Yeah, and just bear in mind, I let Mike kind of have his moment with the song because it's not my personal favorite. It is a good cover for what it is, but I just personally have my preferences in terms of songs on the album.
Oh, yeah. I just have so much history with the Beatles that I had to speak out about this one because even before I listened to this record, like as a whole, I remember hearing this song pretty early in my metal discovery and just digging it back then.
No, that's completely fair. I get where you're coming from. For me, we get to my favorite song on the album, and one thing I will say that this again has the opposite problem with Too Fast for Love, for lack of a better phrase, because this isn't a problem here. The back half of this probably has the best songs on the album, period, for me.
Yeah. Like I said, this is very not front-loaded.
Yeah, so Red Hot, my first note just had to be double bass sections never hurt anybody. And this song really only benefits from some speed. No, not that kind of speed. Get your head out of the gutter. Tommy really is just going nuts on these bass drums here. Much like Bastard, it doesn't waste any time giving you some great playing out of him or Mick. The riffing sounds really good here. It reminds me, if anything, more, it screams more Screaming for Vengeance than it does something by John Bowie, if anything.
Yeah.
Had to get a little bit of some internet meme joke in there. Again, it has more of that old school heavy metal feel in terms of the playing and attitude behind it for me, which I guess is what makes it more of a easier pill to swallow for me.
I have in my notes that this song owes a huge debt of gratitude to Motorhead. Like I hear that double bass in the beginning and I immediately think of Overkill.
No, that's completely fair. I heard little bits of that in there too. Just, this is a genuinely really good song, and I don't understand why the band doesn't play it more. I do wish it would get played more, if anything, you know, but and also I completely forgot to mention this even in our intro for the first episode. Neither of us have seen Motley Crue live in any year at this rate. Like, they've come through Edmonton for me at least like four or five times in the last, I want to say, 15 years, and I've just never seen them,
which is kind of unfortunate because, you know, aside from their most recent appearances, I've heard that like in their prime they put on like great shows.
See, the only person I know of, aside from my cousin, who's actually in a Motley Crue tribute band here locally, my mom's the only one of us in our house that's actually seen them live.
What year did she see them?
It was 2010. It was right after they put out one of their Million Greatest Hits albums.
Oh.
Yeah, she insists to this day that it was a farewell tour, and I'm like, no, Mom, like, I can go to the announcement on Blabbermouth, and it says that it's just to promote a Greatest Hits album. Like, I can actually show it to you. But, yeah, like, she's the only one who's seen them, and the only comment she really had for me is just, they were old.
Maybe that should have been a farewell tour.
I think most people are wishing 2010 was the year they were like, okay, you put out an album that was better, so see ya. Greatest Hits album, goodbye, we're done. But I mean, all kidding aside, like, how cool would it have been if they did a farewell tour around that time? Red Hot was part of the set list, and they actually dug out some more deep cuts.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
I guess with that in mind, next song, which weird enough is also the last single off of the album,
Too Young to Fall in Love,
which apparently was in Grand Theft Auto Vice City, which I wasn't allowed to play a lot of M-rated games, so I didn't unfortunately have the exposure of Grand Theft Auto soundtracks.
But now that you mention it, it totally fits that world.
Oh, definitely 80s Florida, that works. But even for me, I couldn't help but feel that this reminds me a lot more of Judas Priest than it does like Poison or Quiet Riot. Again, it's a very mid-tempo song, but Mick's riff really is just driving this entire track. And honestly, if anything, yeah, is it just repeating too young to fall in love, too young? Like, it's just repeating that for, I want to say, a good solid 3 to 4 minutes. But at the same time, the music behind it really is carrying it.
Yes, as far as like repetitive choruses go, like you said, it's because of what the rhythm section is doing that it makes it more digestible than, I guess, some of their songs from the debut.
Also, I have to give you a bit of a correction. The rhythm section would be just the bass and the drums. The guitar is more just the lead section.
Fair.
Yeah, I didn't want to jump in and say that, but I was like, I need to bring that up. But completely fair. Like, Mick really is doing what... fuck it. I'm just going to bring up one of my cons with this album. If anything, Mick really is who is driving the rhythm, which is, I don't exactly blame you for calling him part of the rhythm section, because I'm just going to be honest, Nikki's bass playing isn't exactly doing much for me. With everybody really going as hard as they can, no pun intended, on these songs instrumentally, his playing really does leave a lot to be desired. I mean, hell, at this stage in their career, Vince even is putting more effort in on this album than Nicky is kind of with his bass parts.
Which kind of sucks to hear, because Nicky was one of my favorite parts of Too Fast for Love. And he kind of pops his head in once in a while on this album. I just wish I would have heard more.
Yeah, Steve Harris, he is not. That's as much as I'm going to say, really. I mean, again, having met him, nice enough of a guy. I only paid $6, so I'm not going to bitch too much, exactly. I'm not exactly expecting the red carpet treatment out of meeting a Motley Crue member, but just honestly, I just wish he could show off a little bit more rather than just kind of either keeping rhythm or just being buried and muddied in the mix.
So now we go to the last three tracks. Knock 'Em Dead Kid.
This is another mid-tempo one, but again, it really is not boring. That's the thing that I can't help but keep saying about all of these tracks that do slow it down once in a while.
The worst thing I'd have to say about this song is at times it can sound a bit too close to Looks That Kill in terms of like the tempo, but the riff is just different enough that it's still enjoyable on its own.
For me, my only other note about this song is it feels more like if you gave the title track from the last record more drive behind the playing on it.
Yeah.
With that all being said, we get to probably, we haven't really talked much about how sleazy Motley Crue is, and this is really the only sleazy song on the album, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, 10 Seconds to Love, like, it doesn't give me any creepy or weird vibes like a lot of bands that take after what Motley Crue do. It really wouldn't be out of place in a strip club, and it'd work really well, honestly. About the same positives I can say for the rest of the album are here, too. It's not one of my personal favorites on the album, but I 100% get why it might be somebody else's. And to give Nikki at least a little inkling of credit, there is one section that does kind of call attention to his playing. It's not thrilling or anything, but it's driving and stands out more than most of his playing on the rest of the album.
This was what I was referring to when I said that, you know, Nikki had his like moments to pop his head out. And this was one of them. 10 Seconds to Love is probably not one of my favorite tracks, but it does have one of my favorite opening riffs. So it's got that going for it.
And like that, we are at the end of this record, Danger. Again, it's not my favorite song on the album, but honestly, I do prefer this a lot more than On With the Show from the last record. It feels like it more belongs here as a closing track and feels like you just wrapped up this half hour of an experience. And that's the thing I like about albums, is that the final track should always just be that final note that makes you go, I just feel like I spent 30 to 40 minutes listening to something that I'm going to be remembering and talking about for years. That's kind of how I feel final tracks on albums should be. And I feel like this gets that job done a lot better than On With the Show did from the last record.
Couldn't have said it better myself. I don't think a lot of people really really appreciate the art of like the track list and track order. Like the opening track has to really set the tone for the rest of the album. And the closer has to like bring everything home, and Danger does exactly that.
And see, that's why I actually wanted to have all of my first impressions of the 80s albums just be how I'm hearing it from the box set, actually just hearing them all front to back as experiences on vinyl. That's why I'm preferring just going through full albums as opposed to just, let's just throw a playlist of songs together and just be like, eh, fuck it. Like that kind of gets boring and old fast to me. I'd rather have a front to back experience that makes me feel like, wow, I spent, in this case, 35 minutes listening to something that really surprised me.
Yeah. And before I get to favorites, because picking favorites off this record was a bit of a challenge, I would say on the whole, this is a no skip record.
Yeah. None of these songs, I would say, even the transitionary tracks, God Bless the Children of the Beast, not a song that is one that I would go, eh, you could have cut that to get rid of a minute and a half. No, nothing like that here. Do you want me to get my favorites out of the way, man?
Yeah. Why don't you start?
So Looks That Kill needs to be there. Red Hot, probably best song on the album. Knock 'Em Dead Kid. And then if I really wanted to go for an honorable mention, Too Young to Fall in Love, just for that Judas Priest-y style riff.
Oh, thank God there's some differences, because yes, I have Looks That Kill on my list, but I also have Bastard Helter Skelter, and Red Hot.
See, I should have also picked Bastard, though, just because it is too good of a punky style song that really works here to the album's benefit. Again, I don't want to just sound redundant and keep repeating the same points we did across the whole half hour that we spent talking about this album, but I would say if you've never heard Shout at the Devil like I hadn't, give it its fair chance. It will surprise you in a lot of ways. The riffing here is really solid. The drumming here is really good. Even Vince sounds good on here. Even with Nicky's bass playing leaving a lot to be desired, he is the main songwriter of the band after all. So if you haven't given Shout at the Devil its fair shake, worst case scenario, you killed half an hour.
Yeah, I kind of have to agree with that. Like, Say what you will about the rest of Motley Crue's discography. Believe me, we will have things to say. This album, just on its own merits, is worthy of a spin.
And we would even suggest picking it up on vinyl, but don't try to pay too much for it, kids. If you can get the box set for like $100, get the box set that I got for $100 off of Amazon. But I mean, you know, again, typically we want to start promoting like where people can actually pick the albums up, but again, to avoid redundancy.
Now, before we go, I do kind of want to tease a little bit of the next record, because Theater of Pain is the big one.
For me, the only comment I really have, I suggested this to Mike off air, saying that we should probably try to work in the music videos, but I also don't want it to just get overcrowded with information or anything. But I've never seen the Smoking in the Boys Room video, and apparently it has Michael Berryman from The Hills Have Eyes in the video. So I, like, you immediately have my attention watching it.
I actually didn't know that about the video, but while we probably won't be talking about all of Motley Crue's videos, that one at least has a hook.
Oh, for me, being the horror nerd I am, and no, I'll bring this up in the episode, but it gets featured in one song in particular, gets featured in one of my favorite movies. So we'll save all of that for the next one.
And until next time, Nick, where can everyone find you online?
Super Saiyan Death Metal God on Instagram and on Threads, the Twitter or X or Elon's baby or whatever the fuck you want to call it, knockoff. I mostly post album covers, movies I'm watching, largely horror movies and action movies, video games I'm playing, and complaining about how god-awful Instagram's algorithm is. So if you want to shoot me some binge likes and you want to know my thoughts on movies that I've just recently watched, that's where you're going to want to find me.
And you guys can find me on various social media at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and that place at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser. Consider supporting our Patreon at patreon.com/renegadepopculture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. Mean escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Jukebox. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.